You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series.
Practicum on Motivation by Love by Jean Maroney.
In January, I got into a political conversation with the wife of a colleague. We were sitting at the same banquet table, and she made some small talk about recycling, expecting me to pick up her lead and run with it. She wanted to bond over sorting garbage. She was disappointed. I smiled at her and I replied that I am morally opposed to recycling. And she reeled. She said, "I thought everyone was in favor of recycling. Why are you opposed to recycling?" So I explained that it made no economic sense, and it was a waste of my time, and that it was immoral for the government to force us to sort our garbage. And someone at the table overheard us and said, "You're an Ayn Rand fan." And several of us had a friendly conversation about the economics of recycling. And then this same woman raised the issue of global warming. You know, if I'm not in favor of recycling, I'm certainly concerned about global warming, aren't I? So I cribbed some notes from The Moral Case for Fossil Fuels by Alex Epstein, and we talked a little bit about that. And by this time, she was really looking stunned. But she'd kind of grasped that I was a right-winger. And she seemed really desperate to make a connection. There got to be some shared value between us. So she said, "Surely I was against illegal immigration." I had to laugh. I said, "No, I was in favor of total free immigration and that there shouldn't be any laws about immigration." Now, this was a networking occasion. And I was also looking to find shared interests. I was there to meet the people at the table, and actually particularly her husband, who I was hoping to get to volunteer for an organization I belonged to. So I thought I'd give her an out. I didn't want to traumatize her. I said, "Well, you know, only about 0.1% of the population agrees with me on politics. So I wasn't expecting you to agree with me. So I didn't want her to feel pressure on that. And we don't need to argue about politics." But no, she wanted to keep discussing politics. I swear she brought up three more topics, all of which I totally disagreed with. But in each one of them, we had a good discussion, and we got the table involved. And I enjoyed myself. Now, I share this story because it was a personal victory. I have been and am still somewhat conflict averse. When political issues come up, I would normally try to demur politely. If the conversation continued, I would get increasingly agitated. By the time I spoke up, I was usually quite defensive. The dinner I told you about is actually the first time that I ever stayed completely relaxed during an extended political argument. I was able to speak up, stay in control, stay curious, have a thoughtful discussion, and engage other people at the table. How? Because I was able to maintain a mindset based on motivation by love rather than motivation by fear. That's the topic of our talk today. This political conversation did not happen by accident. It was the result of work that I had done, both in theory and practice. I've been working on deepening my understanding of the psychological facts that give rise to the need for the distinction between motivation by love and motivation by fear. And this, in turn, helped me appreciate the value of reason, one of those three supreme and ruling values, at a really a deeper level, and helped me develop some practical techniques that could help me stay value-focused in a personally stressful situation. And that is what I would like to share with you today. What is the outline of this approach that helps you focus on values even when you personally are in some kind of conflict? So let's get started by getting clear on these two terms. Leonard Peikoff explains this distinction in Objectivism, the Philosophy of Ayn Rand. It's in the chapter on happiness. He says, quote, "Love in this context means the desire to gain and enjoy a value. Fear means the desire to escape a disvalue." This distinction of motivation by love versus motivation by fear pertains to man's primary motivation, primary motive in a given undertaking. As examples, the man who struggles to create something new in his work and who may, as part of the process, have to fight many obstacles placed in his path, versus the man who wants primarily not to get blamed by the boss or fired. The man who seeks a passionate romance with a kindred spirit versus the man who sleeps with anyone because what he wants is not to be left alone. The man who tends his health in order to be free to live and act versus the hypochondriac obsessed with not being sick. Unquote. Now, I doubt there's any question in your mind which motivation to choose based on that presentation. But in case you're not sure, Dr. Peikoff continues. Quote, "Morality is a means to survival, and the goal of life, as Ayn Rand points out, cannot be attained by the zero-seeking method." He then quotes Ayn Rand. "Achieving life is not the equivalent of avoiding death. Joy is not the absence of pain. Intelligence is not the absence of stupidity. Light is not the absence of darkness. An entity is not the absence of a non-entity. Building is not done by abstaining from demolition. Centuries of sitting and waiting in such abstinence will not raise a single girder. For you to abstain from demolishing. Existence is not a negation of negatives. Evil, not value, is an absence and a negation." That's the end of the Ayn Rand quote, but I'd like to say just a little more from Leonard Peikoff. He says, quote, "Egoism dictates that your primary motivation be motivation by love. Avoiding disvalues is rational, but not as your primary motivation. It's in the context of achieving positives that you also, if you can, avoid negatives." Unquote. So, for example, it could be completely rational to avoid a political conversation if your primary motivation was to communicate some other information, such as the status of your work project. In that context, politics would be a distraction. You would be avoiding a negative in the service of achieving a positive, which was productive work, productive cooperation. That would be an example of motivation by love. But if your primary motivation for not talking about politics was that you didn't want to feel uncomfortable, that would be motivation by fear. Even if you were having the same conversation about the work project. Superficially, it may seem like the same action. You are talking about work instead of politics. But in fact, they are radically different actions because they have radically different motivation. And they will have radically different effects on your long-term happiness. That's why you need to know this distinction between motivation by love and motivation by fear. Now, if you would put up the screen, you can see visually just by imagining what motivation by love is, which is attraction to a positive, as opposed to motivation by fear, which is avoidance of a negative, that we get direction from motivation. But look at motivation by love. It sends us in a definite direction to achieve a definite result. Motivation by fear sends us every which way. You don't know where you're going if you're just avoiding fear. It's actually random whether avoiding that negative will actually achieve life. And of course, the classic example of this is the druggie who is trying to avoid a negative, which is some kind of despair or self-doubt or some other negative feeling. But in the course of it, he's destroying his mind. If you want just a simple explanation of why you should go by love, not fear, that picture gives you the simple explanation. But I think to understand it in full, you need to understand the nature of the human motivational system. So let's talk about what is motivation. Motivation is your motive power. It's that which puts you into action. It's the source of that impulse to move forward, to have the conversation, to do the work, to take the step. Now, many people equate motivation with feelings, but they are not the same thing. The feelings you have, you know, the feeling of hunger or the feeling of love, these are the form in which you experience motivation. The motivation is the cause of the feeling. It's the cause of the feeling. And what is the cause of the feeling? The cause of the feeling is the underlying value or disvalue. Now, you may have heard a value is that which one acts to gain and or keep. That's a generic definition. I want to talk about what is a value in your psychology. A value is really something that gets integrated in your mind. That it's in the psychological sense, it's something that you have associated with pleasure. That's one way to form a value. Like the milk bottle is associated with filling the hunger need, and that's pleasurable. So the milk bottle becomes a value. It could be also formed by having act to gain and or keep it, or even by having concluded logically that it would be good for you and to have set an intention to gain it. In all these cases, there is some kind of mental entity. We don't have a lot of words for this, but the object gains value significance. It gains value significance to you. And because it has value significance, it now has the capacity to trigger emotions. That's what it means to have value significance. The values trigger emotions. So for example, if you were sent to summer camp when you were young and you had fun, camp will be stored as a value because you will associate the fun you had, that pleasurable experience, with camp. When you think about camp, you will feel fondness. A value formed by association creates an emotion when you think about that object. Action also creates it. So I know of someone who, as a child, ran repeated experiments with Legos because he wanted to build structures such that if he threw them against the wall, they could survive. He was obsessed with figuring out how to put together Legos so that when you threw them against the wall, they didn't break apart. And he did it repeatedly. He developed a value for structural mechanics. And in fact, he was drawn to become a mechanical engineer. He created this value by acting to gain and keep it. He acted to gain and keep that knowledge. It became a value to him and became a big part of his life. I think those two cases make a lot of sense. But the third case, I think, is also important. A value can be formed just by setting a goal. You say, I am going to lose weight. And you don't take any action on it. Some people have actual experience with this example. And fortunately or unfortunately, just setting that goal makes it immediately become a value. Immediately. And you know this, because the moment you say that you're going to lose weight and notice that you're not taking any action to lose weight, you start feeling guilty. Losing weight is a value, and you start having emotions in response to it. So that's what a value is in the psychological sense. It's an object that has been tied to pleasure in your subconscious, and as a result, is capable of triggering desires and other emotions. And it's real, right? You can experience it with yourself by experimenting with goal setting. That when you set a goal, you now have feelings about that. Now, it turns out disvalues are completely different from values. Values are formed by a different process. It has a lot of similarities, but every part of it is different. So a disvalue is formed by a painful experience. So, for example, I have a friend who dislikes Indian food. Why? The first time he ate Indian food, he immediately came down with a stomach flu, and he was miserable. And so through no fault of Indian food, he has associated misery with Indian food, and he has an aversion to it. Total by association. Now, that's similar to how you form a value, but instead of association with pleasure, it's association with pain. Similar, you can form a value by acting to avoid something. So I think, for example, I think conflict became an issue for me. I had a real aversion to conflict. It became an issue for me because I avoided it when I was young, probably because I didn't know how to handle it. I didn't know what to do when I was in conflict. I didn't know how to navigate that, and so I just avoided it. But what you avoid repeatedly gains strength as a disvalue. And over time, this became a significant disvalue for me. This is the way old baggage forms, is you avoid something that you should be doing, should in the global sense, not that I knew enough to do differently at the time. But because I did it repeatedly, it became like in my mind, oh no, conflict, oh, that's bad. No one dies in conflict. I don't know if you're aware of that. Big surprise to me, right? Okay. But again, it's what forms a disvalue is avoiding it. So what forms a value is acting to gain something. But what creates a disvalue is acting to avoid it. It's a different process. Similar but different. The third part is also similar but different. You form a value by setting a goal. Well, how do you consciously create a disvalue? I had some trouble understanding this one, but it's real. You can form a disvalue by setting an intention to destroy something. It's an intention to destroy rather than create. This is where you're not just avoiding it, but you are trying to smash it. And you may have met some people who were consciously set on destruction. It's actually a scary thing when disvalues metastasize into actual motivation by destruction. And I do think the current culture has let the dogs out to some degree in this. But it's not just destroyers who can have this. You can see this in yourself or other good people too. And I'll tell you, it sometimes comes up in self-improvement. If you set as your primary intention to eliminate a bad habit, that bad habit immediately becomes a big disvalue, a big negative. And you immediately feel much worse about having that habit. And what can happen, if you don't know better, is you can develop a self-hatred in that regard. And that actually sabotages your efforts at self-improvement. This is just an example of how if you use the wrong kind of motivation, you can inadvertently mess up your psychology and lead to a lot of pain and suffering. I think that these mistakes, when someone is trying to improve themselves and they make the mistake of trying to destroy something within them, that is an innocent mistake. No one would, if they really understood the ramifications of that, they would not do it. It's a tragic mistake. But what I'm hoping you're getting across is these are two different things. When we talk about motivation, we're talking about values and disvalues, not feelings. We're talking about a stored value significance in these objects. that gives rise to the emotions, not the emotions themselves. And they are two completely different systems. Now, this is a really important point, which I learned from a guy named P.J. Eby, I think he may have originated, I'm not sure. Actually, I take that back. Neuroscientists and other kinds of psychologists will tell you that there are various motivational systems. And there are, and if you study neuroscience, there actually are different neurological systems for motivation by fear versus motivation by love. Like things like digestion shuts down in motivation by fear. I mean, I'm not an expert on this, but there really are biological differences in what gets activated. But the psychological importance of this is that these two systems operate independently. They do not integrate. So it turns out, if you're trying to decide what to do, and you have several good options, like you're at a restaurant, and there are several delicious, healthy meals that you could choose from, it is not hard to pick the biggest positive from among those. And if you have several inconvenient, bad options, like suppose there are three inconvenient flights to get to the conference, you can choose the least inconvenient flight. If you're looking at values, you can rate them which is the best. If you're looking at disvalues, you can look at which is the least bad. That is not hard. Everybody can do that. But as soon as you get a mixture of plus and minus on both sides, it becomes actually impossible to make a quick judgment call. And in fact, that's true. Every time you are in conflict, that means there are advantages and disadvantages on both options. Actually, this is called a practicum, right? Most of the practicum is going to be toward the end, but I'd like to start the practicum now by having you take out a piece of paper and just take a minute to think about something that you are in conflict about so that you can see that there are advantages and disadvantages to each option. So, like, this could be something that you should do but you don't want to do, like exercise. That's a classic one, right? Or something that you want to do but shouldn't do, like eat cookies. Another classic. Or it could be something that you can't decide about, like get married. Another classic. But I'd like to actually just be silent for a second and let you all see if you can come up with something in your life. Yeah, you feel pulled in two ways. Now, I'm curious, can you all see that there are advantages and disadvantages on both sides? That you could make a pros and cons list? I mean, that's what a pros and cons list is, right? Pros and cons list is supposed to help you make these decisions. The problem is, making a pros and cons list often doesn't help. It just lays out the mess that you're in. Right? Like, suppose you want, here's an example of a conflict, right? Suppose you want to go on vacation, but you don't think you can afford it. So going on vacation would be great because you'd be revivified. And it would be terrible because it would make you poor. And not going would leave you tired. But it would also be great because you'd feel more comfortable financially. Now, what's the biggest positive here? To be revivified, that's go on the vacation. Well, what's the biggest negative here? To be in financial straits, well, that's to go on vacation. Well, what do you do? If the option that has the biggest positive and the biggest negative is one option, what do you do? You know, there are really only two ways to decide this. You need to, well, actually, let me take that back. Actually, before I go on, is there anyone who would like to actually talk about their case that they came up because it's not clear their advantages and disadvantages? Because it's very important. I'd like all of you to have in mind a conflict as we are talking about what we talk about now so that it's really personal to you. Do you mind going to the microphone so that I can hear you?
The one that I came up with was whether or not to go to graduate school for economics or to just go right into the working force.
Okay, so let's take each of those options. So first, graduate school in economics. So why are you even considering that? Why might you do that?
I'm interested in pursuing the study. I think it'd be really interesting. I'm also considering a career in academia, and people are telling me that I could be successful at it.
Okay, so I'm hearing intellectual stimulation. I'm also hearing that it would give you information about what it's like to be in academia, so more knowledge. So those are positives. Well, why aren't you just doing that?
It's expensive.
Aha, there's your negative. We have an advantage and disadvantage on that. Now, what was the other option?
The other option would be getting a job right out of undergrad.
Okay, so why are you even considering that?
Because I get a bit of more of a head start than by going to graduate school. I'd be able to jump right in, have a little extra time.
So actually, I didn't totally get that, but are you saying you'd be more prepared for graduate school? You could do,
I'd get a head start, so I wouldn't maybe even need to go to graduate school because I'd already be started on a career.
Oh, okay, so what I'm hearing is get started on a career, start being productive. Is that what you're after there?
Yeah, okay. Pretty much.
And why aren't you just jumping in and doing that?
Because I haven't been able to make a decision yet.
Okay, so you want to keep your options open.
Yeah.
So you want flexibility. Mm-hmm. Right. You would lose some flexibility if you just went and did that, and you'd actually like to maybe collect more data.
Yeah.
So there is an advantage and disadvantage on both of the options. You don't always know what they are. This is a perfect example, and I appreciate your bringing it up. Because until you actually ask yourself, okay, what are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? Yes, if you don't have other questions, you can sit down. That's fine. Yeah. Sorry I have to do this because I really can't see you unless I do that. Yeah, thank you. If you... It's helpful to know that if you're in conflict, there are advantages and disadvantages on both sides because they may not spring to mind, but if you pause and you think about it, you can bring them to mind. All I did was ask her a few simple questions, right? Because if you're even considering this option, there must be a positive. And if you're not just doing it, like if there were one that had a whole bunch of negatives and the other one was all positive, you'd probably be doing the positive, right? It probably would be a no-brainer. And the negative, if you aren't doing it, the negative is probably, but I really want to do the other one, which is very revealing when it happens. So it's important to make explicit what is the underlying reason why you're in conflict. And really what you're doing is you're bringing into awareness, explicit awareness, what are the values and disvalues. You know, when you're taking action, you need to know the reasons for your action. That's what going by reason is that you have validated the reason for your action. If you have motivation that is pushing or pulling you in a way and you don't know why, you cannot go by reason because you do not know the reasons. You do not have the full context activated. The purpose of that was to make sure you all have in mind, yeah, positives and negatives on both sides. Again, it sounds obvious, but it turns out to be extremely important. Important to understand that these are two completely different motivational systems because it has a lot of implications for action. And to really grasp this fact that these are coming from two different systems, I think it helps to contrast to motivation in animals who have a similar motivational system. Mammals, really, is what I'm talking about. Cats, dogs, furry things. And these two systems also operate independently in dogs and cats and others. But it works fine because they're at the perceptual level. So, for example, when a animal perceives a threat, so it smells a predator, or it hears thunder, this is a big negative for my cat Mookie is thunder. Oh, that is a big trigger for my Mookie. Or sees a man waving a stick. You know, perception, hears, sees, smells. The motivation by fear system kicks in. That is it. If an animal senses a threat, boom, motivation by fear takes over. You don't need to, there's nothing about motivation by love. It's just avoid the biggest negative. Do the biggest avoidance you can do. The animal goes into fight, flight, or freeze. And of course, this is all instinctual. But this is a, you know, there's a real biological effect here. As I said, you know, there's evidence like digestion stops and things like that. A part of the brain, when they have this awareness, a part of the brain gets triggered and they go into the fight or flight or freeze mode. On the other hand, when there is no threat in perceptual awareness, so it's too far away to be able to smell, or out of sight, out of mind, the animal just operates on motivation by love. And of course, these, we all have, many of us have pets. We love our pets. They're around, they're eating food, they are, they want to play, they're chasing each other. You know, the birds out, we live in Florida now, and in the spring, you see birds doing mating dances and turtles laying eggs. Anyway, it's a lot of fun. And you know what? Most of the time, predators are not in the perceptual range, which is a darn good thing, because these poor animals would be dead if they were. Most of the time, the animal operates to pursue its values, to get the things it needs to live. And that is a very good thing, because to quote Ayn Rand again, quote, achieving life is not the equivalent of avoiding death. Most of that animal's life had better be on gaining values. It takes goal-directed action to gain the values to keep a living organism in existence. I mean, this is a hugely important point, and if you are interested at all in this, you should read Harry Binswanger's book, The Biological Basis of Teleological Concepts. I'm prejudiced, but it is an excellent book. So it makes complete sense that animals have these two systems, and you know, fear triggers in when there's a perceived predator, and it's off when it's not, and it works pretty well. The conceptual level changes all of this. All of this. We can be aware of threats 10, 20, or 30 years in the future. We can think, or some people, not us, can think that we're having a threat of, you know, total takeover of the oceans. But we can visualize and imagine and, in many cases, logically conclude threats in the future. We can also recognize that there could be an imminent risk to us because of something that's happening literally on the other side of the world. Because we're conceptual, we are not limited by the distance of perception. We can be aware over all space and time. If there's no limit, concepts make our ability to know things unlimited, in principle. Of course, we don't know everything, but we could know many, many of these things. So we can't use an automatic switch to turn on fear if we can, are aware of a threat. If we did that, I mean, we're always aware of threats. If we did that, we would be running around Chicken Littles. Now, some people are always in fear mode, and it is not a pretty sight. The truth is, we could also always be aware of opportunities. That's a lot less common. You know, again, this is a fact that's sort of understood out there, but it's not understood philosophically. There's a very good book. I'm going to forget all three of the authors. The first author is Prochaska. It's called Changing for Good, which is about how you change habits. And one of the things they point out, they say, you know, we've observed, before you change a habit, you know, negatives seem to be more powerful than positives. You need twice as many positives as negatives before you're ready to go on and try to make a change, which is sort of an empirical observation that these are two different systems, but they've just kind of turned it into numbers. The truth is they are separate, and we're going to need to choose which we're going to use. And the problem, because we're conceptual and we could put in a lot of time spinning out possible advantages, investigating possible risks. I'm sorry, I didn't catch the name of the person we had up there, but you know, she's not making a decision, which is probably completely legitimate, but until she needs to, because she wants to get more information. That's actually completely rational. But it can also spin out of control. There is such a thing as analysis paralysis. And then the other thing you can do is you can second guess your motivation, like, oh, I'm being pulled to not talk here, or whatever it is. And you say, oh, that's irrational. That's my old baggage. I should actually talk. And it's like you try to second guess everything that's coming in. You get very confused doing that. And it's called self-doubt when you're doubting everything that's coming up from your mind. Now, I actually do believe that with enough time and thought, every conflict can be resolved. There are no necessary conflicts, Ayn Rand says, between rational men, and certainly not within a rational person. There are no necessarily conflicts of interest within your soul. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a conflict that you do not have the capacity to resolve in a really short amount of time. You can tell when you have an unresolved conflict when no matter how much you think about the issue, you still feel conflict over action. You still feel resistance to do what seems like the right thing to do, or you still feel temptation to do what you don't believe is the right thing to do. Now, traditionally, there are two ways of dealing with this, both totally psychologically destructive. So it gets my goat, but anyway. So the intrinsicists assume that you are always correct in your intellectual conclusion about what you should do, and therefore you should just suppress any feeling to the contrary. You should just do whatever it is you gets the word should attached to it. That's what you do. That's the intrinsicist approach, that the should is somehow the revealed truth, and the feeling, that's got to be garbage. Now, the subjectivists take the other side, of course, because that's the way these pairs go. They assume that the strength or the intensity of your emotions is always an indicator, a valid, accurate indicator of the values at stake or the importance of the values at stake. And therefore, if your conclusions disagree with some intense feeling, there must be a mistake in your conclusions. And therefore, you should go with what you feel. And these are both wrong. They are wrong, 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 very destructive. And I'm sure every single person in this room has done one or the other at various times because they're the only things that we're taught. And to figure out the third way takes the application of objectivism. They're wrong because man is fallible. Both are trying to operate at the perceptual level with actually dealing with the complexity of the situation. Moreover, neither of these methods actually resolves the conflict. They perpetuate the conflict. That's what gets my passion going. This is anti-human. I can say more in the Q&A about how they perpetuate the conflict, but they do. Now, I want to remind you of what Ayn Rand said about happiness. She said, quote, happiness is a state of non-contradictory joy. A joy without penalty or guilt. A joy that does not clash with any of your values and does not work for your destruction, unquote. This fellow P.J. Eby I mentioned has a great line for what the opposite, what suffering is. He says, suffering is a divided mind. The removal of conflict is critical to your long-term happiness. The resolution of conflict within your soul is critical to your long-term happiness. Suffering is a divided mind. Every internal conflict, when you resolve it, increases your overall happiness. Every internal conflict that is allowed to fester deepens your suffering. That can't be right for an egoist. We need a completely different approach, one that resolves the conflicts rather than lets them fester. So I'm going to quote Leonard Peikoff again. He's going to explain the basic point in a slightly different from a slightly different context, but it really applies here. Quote, with the advent of the human species, the need to project the future reaches its climax. The temporal scale of man's concern must not be any isolated day or cycle, but his entire lifespan. Just as man's knowledge must be integrated into an all-encompassing sum, so must his actions. And then he quotes Ayn Rand. Quote, if he is to succeed at the task of survival, man has to choose his course, his goals, his values in the context and terms of a lifetime. Unquote Ayn Rand, continuing Leonard Peikoff, this is again from Opar. Here then is the problem. Man must be long range. He must know the survival significance of every action he takes. And he must know it in relation to the time span of an entire human life. This is your future happiness at stake in your choice of action right now. Back to Leonard Peikoff. The problem is, what can make such a cognitive feat possible? The answer is, the same kind of consciousness that makes it necessary. Unquote. We have a conceptual, volitional, introspective consciousness. We need a conceptual, volitional, introspective means of choosing between options in a conflict. We know in principle what we need to do. We need to make a choice based on values, on the motivation by love standard. We need to make values, not disvalues, the primary motivation for our action. But how do you do it? How do you do it in the middle of conflict? How do you reconcile these negative and positive motivation and resolve the conflict? You go to the fundamental. Values are the fundamental. Whatever confusion or conflict you have, the key is, what are the values at stake in this moment? If we think we should be doing something, to gain what value? If we feel a certain emotion, it was caused by a value that is at stake. What is the value that caused this emotion? If we see a disvalue as the source of our motivation, well, what's a disvalue? Disvalues are that which threatens or harms a value. That's all they are. Any disvalue is actually a value in disguise. You would not have a disvalue unless there was some value that you thought was being threatened and you were trying to protect. So when you have a disvalue as part of your motivation, you need to simply dig deeper into what is being threatened or harmed. You need to find the value at stake. This doesn't mean that you ignore the disvalues, but you look at them from a completely different perspective. You look at how they affect our pursuit of values, not whether they motivate us. You know, disvalues become, when you make this shift, you don't throw out the disvalues, you just say, wow, this is the situation I'm in. There are some negative situations here, and I want to get there. How do I get there, navigating the terrain between here and there? Navigating around these negatives that I've discovered. They become part of the reality, that the world that you are working through, while you keep the value in mind as your goal. The whole lesson of today's talk is, rational action is action explicitly motivated by values, not rules, not feelings, not disvalues, not anything else. It's action explicitly motivated by values, all of those other things. Whatever other reason you have for doing something can be translated with enough intellectual work to figure out what is the value at stake with it. All rules, feelings, and disvalues are leads to implicit values. But to further our lives, we need to know those values explicitly. It is only motivation that is explicit. You need to know that you're wanting time for flexibility. You need to know what the values are. It's only if they're explicit that you can be sure that you're seeking to gain a value, that you are can look for the biggest value, that you can know you are not going after some kind of destruction or stopping in fear. And if we make those values explicit, we know whatever value we pursue will be in principle furthering our lives. Now that's a little bit abstract. That is like the big abstract point of the talk. And I'd like to concretize it using a personal example related to the opening story I had. So one of the reasons my conversation at that dinner table in January was such a personal victory was that I had been in a situation just 1 month before in which I had been extremely conflicted about speaking up. Extremely. All my whole life of conflict aversion had kind of come to a head in this story that I'm going to tell you. So I had attended a 9-day intensive in the United Kingdom on communication skills. The skills that were taught were excellent. The faculty were excellent. There were about 90 people at the event, very intense. Unfortunately, there was a large group of rabid environmentalists at this event. And I saw, early on, I saw some notices. They were gathering. They had some extracurricular activities. And, you know, since this was not part of the purpose of the intensive, and my purpose was to learn the skills, I pretty much ignored that activity. I think that was the right thing to do. But toward the end of these 9 days, at this event where basically people are getting closer, and part of what you're trying to learn is how to be open to another person who doesn't necessarily agree with you, and find the way that I see what we were learning is find the best within other people. That's actually what I think this method, which I can tell you about if you want, does. But that's a perspective I bring as an egoist. That's not the way it's taught. But it had brought us closer together. And some people were letting their hair down. And at one of the group meetings with all 90 of us in the room, one of the other attendees went on a rant. He was ranting about a decision by the London City Council, which just recently voted to make London carbon neutral by 2050. Now, I hadn't heard this before he said it, and my reaction to hearing that the London City Council had voted to go carbon neutral by 2050 was shock and horror. I mean, the thought of the coming destruction of London, one of the most important cities in the world, I mean, it's just, I mean, it hit me like a ton of bricks. But this person was distressed because they were waiting so long. He ranted. I don't know how long it was because I kind of went into a time distortion there, but it seemed like forever. He ranted for about 5 minutes about how horrible it was that they weren't taking this more seriously and doing this sooner. And in the course of the rant, in addition to my horror at the vote and my horror at his view of it, I realized that the room was with him. They may not have all agreed exactly, but they were feeling his pain and they were supportive of him. And I knew that was wrong. This is actually very helpful for me to understand you do not give empathy to everyone. This was destructiveness in front of me. This person was out for destroying the city of London, and this couldn't be sanctioned. A part of me really wanted to speak up, but I was literally shaking in horror. Fear, outrage. I mean, I remember sitting there reminding myself to breathe because I was totally over the top. And it was I'm sure it comes across, it was a very difficult situation. But fortunately, I remembered something that one of the teachers had told us. She drew this picture at the beginning of the conference. I don't think this is original to her. But she drew three circles. Right? The inside circle is the comfort zone. The outside circle is the panic zone. Between the comfort zone and the panic zone are the stretch zone. Is the stretch zone. The reason she put it up here is because we knew this could be an emotional undertaking. It's a lot about dealing with your emotions when you're trying to communicate with other people. Managing your own emotions is actually your number one task. That is your number one task. And she had said, look, you're here to learn. You can't learn in the comfort zone. In the comfort zone, you do what's familiar. You don't learn anything new. So don't stay in your comfort zone. But you also can't learn anything in your panic zone. Now Jean talking. Right. I'm thinking, yeah, that's right. I'm in a panic. My brain is exploding here. I can't think. And so what I'm saying is you can't learn in the panic zone because you can't think in the panic zone. You can't reason in the panic zone. Oh, my God. I need to get out of the panic zone. That's why, and that was actually very helpful for me. In the stretch zone, where you're somewhat uncomfortable, you can learn new things, you can deal with conflict, and that's the place that you should learn. So I was sitting there, remembering these three circles, realizing I was in the panic zone. I realized, okay, and I focused more on breathing and calming down. Breathing, in case you don't know, I think everybody knows this, but in case you don't know, breathing does help you calm down. It does two things. It pauses. Emotions have a time course, so time actually helps calm emotions. But it also literally relaxes the body. That is a good thing because when you're in a lot of emotion, you tense up. And it does provide oxygen for your brain, which many people believe is a good thing. So remembering this picture and realizing, oh my God, I'm in the panic zone. Okay, all right, so all I need to do is just breathe, breathe. You're in the panic zone, Jean. Just calm down, calm down. Okay, that calmed me down a little bit. And what it really helped me realize was that in that moment, I was incapable of replying publicly. Part of me wanted to get up there and do something. But that was really terrifying for me. And it was clear to me I could not do that in a rational manner. If I had done that, I might have foamed at the mouth. I might have screamed like an animal. I don't know what I would have done, but it would have not been a rational response. And, you know, I'm really committed to reason. So I took that off the table. And I'll tell you, that was a painful realization. It was clear to me that remaining in my seat and not speaking up was necessary for me to maintain my mental faculties. I needed to take care of my mind. Your mind is your highest value. It was more important that I could keep going by reason than that I do anything else, whether there was an implied sanction or anything else. I'm going to remind you what Ayn Rand said about reason. Quote, to live, man must hold three things as the supreme and ruling values of his life. Reason, purpose, self-esteem. Reason as his only tool of knowledge. Purpose as his choice of the happiness which that tool must proceed to achieve. Self-esteem as his inviolate certainty that his mind is competent to think and his person is worthy of happiness, which means is worthy of living. These three values imply and require all of man's virtues. Unquote. Now commenting on this, Leonard Peikoff says, quote, the greatest of them, however, which makes the others possible, is the first reason, in case you lost track. Epistemology tells us that reason is valid. It is man's means of knowledge. Ethics draws the practical conclusion. If one chooses to live, one must hold reason as a value. If you wonder what it means to hold reason as a value, this incident, in which I chose to act in a way to keep my mind functioning, is an example. I was holding on to reason as a value, and that was the beacon. That was what was motivating me, was the value of reason. You know, every time you take a step toward a value, you get clarity. I mean, when you see what the value is, you get clarity. It gives you direction. You take a step toward it, you feel efficacious. Clarity, direction, efficacy, these are all the building blocks of self-esteem. Calm me down a little bit more and brought another round of values up. So when you're in conflict, the thing I want to say here that this story is demonstrating, this is not just bang, bang, done. That's what the intrinsicists and the subjectivists want. They want a fast answer. I'm sorry, if you're in conflict, this is your life. These are your values. You need a little bit of time because it's going to be like this. You're going to take the first one, and then you get a little traction, and then the next one is going to come up. So let me tell you what the next one that came up was. The next thing that hit me like a ton of bricks was my longing to have the emotional resilience to be able to handle that kind of emotional intensity. I am a very passionate person, and it has been my downfall. And one of the reasons I was at that conference was to get more skill at being able to stay emotionally grounded so I could keep my brain in gear. But this was way beyond what I could handle. And upon this insight, I realized, wow, this is why I'm here. I have learned something from being here because I stayed out of the panic zone. Like, good for me, I stayed out of the panic zone. Well, I mean, I got out of the panic zone. I didn't stay out of it. You can't always keep yourself out of the panic zone. But I recognized that, I calmed down, I focused on values. Okay. And that calmed me down some more. And I recommitted to, I'm going to learn this skill. This is a learnable skill. I'm going to learn it. I've learned a lot. I'm going to learn it even more. And that calmed me down enough so I could finally look at the other side. Right? I had decided not to speak up. Well, I could now turn to the value on the other side of this conflict, the side that wanted to speak up. I wanted to be able to communicate my ideas. I wanted to be able to communicate objectivism. I'm seeing London destroyed by the lack of the proper ideas. I was longing to express myself. And sitting there felt like a sanction of the wrong ideas because the mood of the room was so supportive of him. My integrity was at stake. And I'll tell you, about this time, I started crying quietly. I tried to stay quiet. It was a real experience. It seemed like that my mind and integrity were on opposite sides of the conflict. And in truth, there's a sense that they were, given my skills at that moment. Now, as I said before, in principle, there is no necessary conflict between your values. There's certainly no inherent conflict between moral values. They all support each other. But you can get yourself into a practical situation where you do not have the knowledge or the skills to be guided by them at the same time. You just don't see a way forward that gains both values right now in this action. And this was a very dramatic case in my life. But this happens in your life too. How many of you have been in a time crunch? You wanted to get a report done, you wanted it to be high quality, and you wanted it on time. But now there's an hour left, and you got a choice. You can either get an extension and get it high quality, or you can lower your standard and get it in on time. Those two things, right in this concrete, practical situation, though you can't have them both right now. These are the situations that are particularly disastrous to use the just do it method or the just go by what you feel. Because both of these values are important to you. There are strong, important values on both sides of this conflict, and you need to honor those values. Whereas when you just say, just do it, forget that, just do it, or just go by what you feel, you are denying the value on the other side. The intrinsicist and subjective approach assume that there is not a value on the other side, and as a result, you betray one of your values. The actual alternative is to honor the values on both sides, and this requires getting clear on them, which is often emotional, and temporarily, it can be quite painful. As I sat there mourning the fact that I saw no practical way to speak up, mourning is a way of honoring the value that you don't have right now. And recognizing that it still is a value in your hierarchy, even though you don't have a means of getting it. Another alternative occurred to me. So at this conference, because there were 90 people, they actually broke us up into a group of six. And they had everyone meet with their, it was called their home buddies, or home group, I forget, every day. And so I had five other people that I'd gotten to know over the course of 8 days, and I had developed some trust with them. And I decided at that moment that although I couldn't express myself here, I was going to tell those other five people the next day in our meeting. And, you know, when you set, I told you that when you set a goal or set an intention, positive, that you are forming a value. Well, my intention to express myself was reinforcing that value, and I had a little bit of the experience of gaining, of basically acting with integrity because I was acting to gain and keep my value. Not in the way that it had seemed I should do, but because I knew the value at stake, I could find another way toward it. And I also rededicated myself in that moment to gaining the skills so that I would not be in this situation again. Now there's more to this story, but I'm just gonna say, the conversation the next day led to several other conversations. And between then and the end of the intensive, which all had they all had a little bit of conflict in them. They were all learning experiences. They were all in the stretch zone for me. But it led directly to my having that conversation at that banquet table in January. It led directly to it. You could trace what I learned over the course of that month. And that's why it was such a victory for me. I saw that I had gained demonstrable skill since that tortured moment 1 month earlier. This is only possible because I had been very aware of what the values were. So this method that I'm going to offer to you, this is not fun and games. You know, when you hear motivation by love, it's like, oh, this sounds great. We're going to have fun. This will be nice. No, no, no. This is serious work. This is being willing to be present with the values that really matter to you, knowing the meaning of your action at the time. And the method is very simple in its essence. It's just you keep in your driver's seat, handling the emotions, identifying the values at stake, taking small, sometimes very small steps towards them. Rational action is action explicitly motivated by values, not rules, not feelings, not disvalues. If you can stay with your mind functioning, keep uncovering the values and contributing to the that are contributing to the conflict, you can get clearer. It becomes clear what is the top value or what is the first one. If that's clear, wonderful. If not, you keep uncovering and honoring them and taking the steps that you can, one value at a time. To paraphrase Ayn Rand, You keep uncovering and honoring the values with the recognition and acceptance of reason as your only source of knowledge, your only judge of values, and your only guide to action. Now, in practice, so it's simple. The concept is very simple, and I hope I've gotten the concept across. In practice, it is a lot to think about. And I've kind of broken it down to three steps. When you notice that you are in this kind of conflict, how to switch to a values focus. The first thing you need to do is to accept the reality you face. This is where you handle the disvalues. You know, disvalues, you identify the threats, you identify the disvalues, you find out if they're real. Of course, some threats are not real. You mourn a bit for things that you wish were true that aren't true. You know, we talk a lot about accepting reality. Do you know what accepting reality means? It's accepting your emotions about the situation. When you emotionally accept, yeah, this is negative is true, that's what accepting, when reality is a negative, that's what it means to accept reality. You cannot think or act if you're totally overwhelmed with negative emotions, so you need to get out of the panic zone, and that's what this accepting the reality you face does. The second step is identify all of the values at stake. And I've got another little crib here. The problem is that many of the values are implicit, so you need to go after all of your reasons and find the values. Disvalues, well, they're a threat to a value. Emotions, well, they're based on an evaluation that comes from a value. Rules, suppose you use rule, well, I have to do this or I should do this. Well, that comes from some judgment of moral value that this was good. They often come without clarity about what the values are. You need to take the extra steps and find out what the value is. Making the values explicit is your number one goal. If you do nothing else, if you make the values explicit, you will be in the driver's seat. And then once you make them explicit, you take the largest practical step you can toward one of the values. One of the values. This is very important. In the crucible of conflict, when you are in that difficult situation, you may not know what is best. All you can do is make sure that what you're going after is good, and you know why it's good. And that's what taking a step is. Now, on the one hand, this may sound simple. On the other hand, it may sound complicated. This process, done consistently, in every action that you feel conflict about, over time, resolves all your internal conflicts. We talk about this in the Thinking Lab. Every time you resolve a conflict, you increase your happiness for the rest of your life. And this little three-step process is the motor that does it in the present, helps you stay focused on values. You know, my goal, we are in a talk, so there's a limit to what you can do in a talk. But my hope is that you've got an inspiration that this is possible and that you want to try to learn more about how to do it. And so with that, what I would like to do is switch over to questions and examples. We only have one microphone, but I would like anyone who has the best way for us to spend the rest of our time would actually be in talking about an example of a conflict. So if anyone has an example of a conflict that they would like to talk through about what does it mean to accept the reality? What does it mean to identify all the values at stake? What does it mean to take the largest practical step? I'd like to give preference to that person. But I also will take questions. So does anyone in line have an actual example?
Yeah, I know I do.
You do? Okay, yeah. So we'll give you first, and then
okay. And then
the person who was first can be second. Okay, great.
I'm kind of have a conflict between, I want to write a novel, mm-hmm. It's called Philosophy. And then I also have a brand. I'm the guy who has the 3D printed stuff in there. And I want to start this company called Geometry.
Okay.
And I feel like I'm like equally passionate about both. Like I think more about the fiction writing, but I feel like I spend more time doing the 3D printing business.
Okay.
So I guess I'm just kind of torn. I feel like I'm not writing enough. And so, yeah, that's the main
thing. So let's actually start with, so basically number one, accepting the reality you face, we're going to look at the negatives here. So what are the negatives right now of doing what you're doing? So first of all, the negatives of not writing.
Yeah.
What's that about? What's bad there?
It makes me, I guess I feel like, you know, I'm not pushing the novel forward because I've written a few chapters, right? But it feels like I've just been putting off the actual concretization of my ideas. Like I have the whole story thought through,
okay,
but I haven't put the words out.
All right. So what I want to try to get at is either a disvalue or a value. So what I heard is it feels like I'm putting it off.
Yeah.
Now, I think there's an actual feeling there, and I think I can put a name on it, but I wonder if you can first.
Yeah. Oh, what is it? Procrastination.
So that's not an actual feeling, but that's okay. How about guilt?
Guilt, yeah.
Is guilt the feeling that you're feeling?
Yeah.
So one of the things, learning how to name your feelings, that's another class. There are other classes on that.
Right.
But if you feel guilt, that means that you're not living up to your own standards. That's where guilt comes from. So what's the standard you're not living up to? What's the value there?
The value is, I guess, accomplishing, or filling it in.
Okay, so accomplishing, what I'm hearing is progress, you know,
yeah,
just as a kind of a generic. But there's more than that, too. Tell me what the meaning of this novel is to you.
I guess to inspire people to basically think through both sides of an issue, basically reconciling extreme positions and like realizing, you know, how to be unbiased, right? So I take these.
How to be unbiased. How to be unbiased.
Yeah.
So you have a big communication goal and an inspiration goal. So we're just going to put these down. These are some more values that are coming up. And so what's happening is you're not getting the communication out. You have this vision, which you're making no progress on. These are actually, we're getting to values over here. The guilt is because you're not getting any of these things. Okay. What are some of the facts here? Like you're putting, how much time are you putting on the novel versus the other?
Yeah, so, I mean, the facts are, I used to, over the winter, I was putting in maybe an hour a day on writing.
Okay.
Or less, half hour maybe.
Okay.
And, then I started to get my printer working again, and it's essentially shifted to where I've totally not been putting any work in on the novel.
So there's no time. So this is I'm just looking at reality here. So there's no time on novel. That's
right.
The fact right now. Now, what would happen? We're looking at negatives here. What would happen if you started putting time on the novel? I mean, there's a reason you're not putting time on it.
It would take time away from.
Yeah, but what would happen? What bad would happen? Because if nothing bad would happen, you would be doing it.
If I didn't put time into it, you're saying?
Yeah.
If I started putting time into it?
If you started putting time into the novel, what terrible things would happen?
Essentially, I mean, it's just like opportunity cost, right? So I think about...
But
like,
let's be more concrete here.
Yeah.
Because if you... Opportunity costs are real abstract. I mean,
yeah,
you're trying to build a business here?
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that's the real thing.
So what's the fear? There's
fear
a fear.
Is I won't put enough time in to make the business successful, yeah.
So the business will fail. So you want
yeah
to actually be really blunt about
right
this. This is part of accepting realize. So there's a risk of the business failing.
Or not growing at the pace that I'd like, yeah.
And how real is that risk? Let's be really clear.
I mean, it's pretty real. You know, I have a lot of stuff. It's like even with that, I feel like I haven't been putting enough time into the printing of the company.
So part of the reality is you don't have enough time even given what you have. Now, this is a classic entrepreneurial problem. Right. Partly, are you a one man band?
Yeah, it's one man. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is a classical problem. So you don't have enough time as it is. If you were to put time into this, you would really put the business at risk.
Exactly.
So when I say accept the reality you face, this is real. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So the risk, your business is at risk. And actually the real reality here is your business might even be at risk with just you working on it.
Right.
That's a little scary.
Totally, yeah. I need to get a partner. That's the hard part.
Well, so, and don't laugh, because this is actually really important.
Yeah.
Were you thinking about getting a partner before?
Well, I actually had somebody who I was talking to and meeting with for a little while.
So it's been on the radar.
Yeah.
But this facing reality, my God, you know, it seems like it's about the novel. But in fact, 1 hour a day could kill the business. This means the business is at risk, right? I mean, that, you know, I'm doing everything I can, and I still feel like I don't have enough time. This is the kind of thing, this was not obvious from the way that he first said it. This comes from really looking at what are the negatives? What are you really afraid of here? You're afraid of, you're never going to get your vision out. I'm not sure my notes here are perfect. You're never going to get your vision out, and the business is going to fail, and you could do both of those failures.
Right.
Right? So this is not pleasant. I want to give you a little empathy here. It's
stressful, yeah.
What's that?
It's very stressful, yeah.
It's stressful, yeah. And you know, really great businessmen are really clear-sighted about this is the situation we're in. And that's what I think you've just got. You've gotten really clear-sighted that there is a real... that there is a real choice here. You know, one of the reasons you're in conflict is you think you can have them both.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And one of the reasons that you need to accept the reality you face is it may be that that is wishful thinking.
Yeah. And I might have to, that's what I've thought of, is maybe I have to just put off the novel
so
because it's less dependent on timing.
I'm just
going
to say, instead of have to, get to, but let's do the next part of it. So now let's make sure we know all the values at stake. So I didn't hear yet about the values. This, you know what? I'm going to try a new piece of paper because I don't like this piece of paper. This was unclear. So we know some values. We've got communication. I'm just going to abbreviate it. We've got, I'm not going to put progress up there because that's too generic.
Right.
But tell me some of the other values like on the 3D project.
Yeah, so like I want to get into the, I guess create really. I mean, when you say values of the project, I guess.
Yeah. Well, why? Like, I mean, why are you excited about this?
I'm excited because I want to get people like I don't like the idea that you have to buy something that's like generic, and so I want to live in a world where like everything that you buy is personalized. Or, like, customized.
So you have a real vision.
Yeah.
Of customer service vision, actually, is what I would say. I'm gonna put it in a generic sense. Is that okay?
Yeah.
But this is a real value to you. Customer service.
Or custom
customization.
Service. Yeah, customization.
And my guess is, because you're an entrepreneur, there's a pride of creation, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's creation here. Now, I bet there's creation on this side, too. Right? You've got this vision for this novel?
Totally, yeah. I mean, and it's tearing me apart because I feel like it's a balance between customizing products versus intellectually stimulating people to be unbiased.
Right, so intellectual stimulation. And this is also, the other value here is, I'm stopped writing clearly. I'm sorry.
That's okay, it's better than my handwriting.
Okay. The other thing that I'm hearing here is you want to help people cooperate. You want to help people communicate. You want to help, you know, harmony is maybe a little too frou-frou, but there's something like that that you're really after.
Yeah.
You're after having good people be able to relate to each other without unnecessary conflict. Am I right about that?
Yeah, I want, like, I want to inspire, let's say, a Trump and Hillary supporter to be able to work out, you know, their differences, or basically see the other side of the issue.
Yeah. So you want it.
A lot of it has to do with like Alex's talk. Actually, it's essentially fictionalizing his talk yesterday that he gave at the end.
Okay,
of the day.
Okay. Great.
Yeah.
So this is important to you, and so is this. And another thing you haven't put here yet. What about like wealth? Is this, I mean, do you have the entrepreneur bug?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's more like wealth is a motivation. Like, I want to have, you know, nice things, but it's not so much wealth as just financial freedom.
Freedom, yes, yeah. Freedom is actually much better. Mm-hmm. Freedom, wealth is usually a means to freedom. Okay. So I don't know. So this is, I think these are the values at stake here. You do not have to choose this second between these two. But what you do in this moment is you think about, well, these are my values. Now, there's not just one way to achieve these. Like, for example, I'm just going to make something up here, right? Like, if you decide, wow, I really want this business to go somewhere, the business needs everything I can get, one of the most important, I need to figure out how to make this work, and then, you know, maybe I can do the book later. Maybe I need a partner. I didn't actually finish that sentence. Some people laughed when you said, maybe I should get a partner, but this is the kind of thing that comes up when you start really seeing what the reality is and what the value is. If you want to have momentum in your business and success with your business, you probably do need to have at least one other person on your team.
Yeah, and I'm not very technical, and I know that there's going to be a lot of technical.
So this suddenly becomes more urgent, and it becomes more clear that the whole project is at stake. So it actually creates urgency for doing something that you maybe knew in the back of your mind needed to be done. And if you notice, getting a partner would conceivably also free up some time so you could work on this project.
Yeah.
Now, that's not the only solution. Once you know what the values are, there are other solutions. Like, for example, writing this novel, this sounds like a lot of fun. I mean, you've got this idea. Okay, I'm going to give you three other ideas. You could get someone else to ghostwrite it, to me is horrifying, to get someone to ghostwrite my story. Horrifying.
Yeah, I'm definitely writing it.
What's that?
I said, I'm definitely writing it, but one thing I want to say...
All I'm saying, so this is not to talk you into something. Yeah. What I want to say is when you know what the value is and you know what the constraints you're under, the mind works by values and will suggest other ways to get them. So I'm just saying ghostwriting, or you can do this same thing on a small level. Like tell this story to plan every lunch you have, you tell this story to a different person. So that you're actually working on the story at lunch when you're networking, but you're not going to write it until later. I'm just making this up.
Yeah.
But the point is you can actually take a small step to this within the constraints that you have, but only if you're really clear on the values.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that one thing I've thought about is that the novel is an easier thing to put off because one of the things about starting a company is it's all about timing.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I put off the company, there's going to be competition that comes into the markets.
That could be an issue. And I'll tell you, the other thing about a novel, I am not sure you can write a novel on an hour a day.
Yeah. It'll take a while.
Right. Which is another under accepting reality. That's another
right.
thing. Okay. So does this make your values a little bit clearer?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you for sharing that example.
All right, yeah.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. All right. And now I'll take questions. We don't have much time, but
so
we've got at least one.
Mine is going to be a bit less concrete, but it works on concretizing your first step of three, is that it seems like it's a pretty consistent source of conflict, like actually determining how realistic a goal may be.
Say that a little bit.
Determining how realistic a specific goal may be.
Oh.
So that often with objectivists, they might say, well, Rourke could do anything, John Galt could do anything, I can do anything.
Yeah.
In reality, a lot of our goals might be dependent on cooperation from others or like legislation, not going to jail for like plastic straws. But you know, I wanted to ask you how do you see like the role of like actually determining
what's realistic.
Right.
Right. So this is a great, I'm glad you brought up this issue, because part of accepting reality sometimes is accepting what skill you have. Like for me in that moment at that lecture, that I did not have the skill to be able to, you know, publicly, I could have. If I had raised my hand, I could have talked after him and said something. That would have been permissible in the situation. But I didn't have the skill to be able to do that. And it's really demoralizing to realize you don't have a skill that you wish you had. So that's got a lot of negative emotions around it, which if you don't process, it becomes like this tunnel vision, which either you become, you fantasize that you can do it and you never really face the fact of what your actual skill level is, so you never take any steps. Because if you took a step, you would find out that you don't have the skill level, and so a defense can create that way. Or So that's actually a hugely important issue, and that's part of accepting reality. The same thing about these other things, like business, like what are the regulations and what is the actual risk of getting thrown in jail, things like that. These all are negatives that need to be handled under accepting reality. And the point is, these do not determine what you do, right? These make it clear what is the terrain. In order to get to your goal, do you need to climb a mountain and then skydive off the other side? Or are you going to take a walk in the park, right? That's what accepting reality does, is it gets you really see what is the world out here. I have a value that I would like, and if I'm going to get it, I'm going to need to get, you know, I'm going to need to go over here, and I'm going to need to learn this skill. I'm going to need to do this. I'm going to need to do this. And it's in that context you decide whether that value is worth it. You know, there are some things that you're going to do it or die trying because it's that important. And, you know, I mean, that's the way I feel about the work that I'm doing. My goal is to learn not just how to essentialize, but how to teach people how to essentialize. And believe me, when I figure it out, I will tell you. It's hard. But, I'm going to do it or die trying. I've been at it for 29 years. Yeah, July 8th, it will be 29 years. I am going to do it because it's been very hard. And I had to go listen to those environmentalists. But that is not every goal. And so the reason you get clear on the terrain is to decide whether you want to go after that value or not. So you see the value in the full context. And the truth is, if it's really important, you take some steps and you eventually develop the skill and you gain the knowledge. That's actually, let me just end with this slide. That's why the third thing is take a step. You don't gain values without taking a step. You don't learn what you need to learn without taking a step. This is all about taking a step. But taking a step, not just a small step. There are 1,000 self-help people who will say, take a small step. No, no, no. Identify the value. Take a step in the direction of the value. That's what the message of this class is. And I hope that you will bring that to your lives and go out and conquer the world. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to aynrand.org.